Going Linux, episode 77, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
Currently, we create 3 episodes a month. We release listener feedback episodes at the beginning of each month and user experience episodes near the end.
Following the third Tuesday of each month, we post Larry's appearances on the live Computer America show.
In our user experience episodes, we take 2 months to cover a topic, first an introduction, then an in-depth look at the Linux operating system and its applications.
And in today's episode, we have listener feedback. We hope you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
Tom, I am so glad you've got your Skype running again.
Oh, my
God. What the heck happened?
Well, I was over on Linux News. It's LX or LXER.com.
Uh-huh.
And there was a glowing article about the new beta for Skype and how much better the sound was and the new features. And right there was a link to take you to where you could download the beta. And I did. And it completely broke my sound. Going into options and audio devices, I had one choice, Pulse Audio.
And okay.
I had no idea. So I went into the forums and tried. Some people found ways around it and were monkeying around with it. I will say that the text was very, very clear. But... no audio, no video, and I was pretty much stuck because Skype works so well. I got rid of my wired phone, my home telephone.
Right.
Oh, so I'm okay. Using Skype, and I have a cell phone too, but I really rely on Skype. Being a beta version, I figured I'll try it out. If I don't like it, I'll just download the stable version again, and away I go.
Sure.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Skype does not have the stable version available for download. If you go there and you look in Linux downloads, all there is the broken beta version and nothing else.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So Bill found me an older version, but that version, we found out when we tried to record a little earlier, doesn't work with Skype audio recorder.
Right.
And so then you found me. Where did you find the copy you found? Oh, it was on one of your machines.
Usually what I do is I download, for Skype anyway, I download the .deb file and save it to my hard drive in a directory I call software and just leave it there just in case.
Yeah,
and
well, that
this
was
is
a
one
good
of
idea.
Those just in cases.
So everybody that's listening to this, if you see the nifty, new, shiny, bright beta version to download, do not do it. It's horrible. You'll be stuck and disappointed. And you people at Skype, duh.
Well, you know, when you make a beta, you should always leave the production version available. You shouldn't force people to stick with the beta because one of the reasons you call it a beta is because it is being tested. Beta is
exactly.
Short for beta testing, not beta production.
And on the way in, it did give me this little warning saying, you probably shouldn't install this unless you are tolerant of seeing the occasional error message.
Yeah, which normally is what's included in beta software.
So, okay, that's my rant for today. Skype got stupid. I hope they fix it.
Yeah, well, I hope they fix it as well, and... I know you had to reinstall, and you even tried, from what you were telling me, you even tried compiling from source code. And
yeah, the Linux call recorder, I mean the Skype call recorder, I thought maybe if I compiled that from source code, not an easy job, by the way, that it would be keyed in and geared toward my computer more. I don't know what I was thinking. It's all magic after a certain point.
Bottom line is, I'm glad you're back up and running, Tom.
Thank you. Me too. And we should get into this. We have a lot of email this month. And yes. Probably too much. I don't know if we're going to hit them all. And if we don't, we'll get them next time, right?
Yep, that's right. Okay, so let's get started with an email from Gil. Tom, this might get a little ugly, and we may need to tag team on this long email.
Is he going to come after us for bashing Microsoft?
He's, well, just a little.
All right.
Gil says, hello, guys.
Hi, Gil.
First, let me say you two are doing a great service for the Linux community by showing the newbie users how to use Ubuntu Linux. I always look forward to all your podcasts and your keep it simple approach. I'm writing in regards to, quote, John's feedback concerning OS bashing. I love everything involving computers. I really agree with what John had to say. I see that from what I read, listen to, and view, that everyone has their favorite and some defend it to the maximum degree. But the main groups are Windows, Apple, and Linux users. If only Linux existed, I believe people would argue which distro is the best. Such is human nature. It seems for some, their way is the only way. The way I see it, because of these differences, the development software is being pushed to new levels all the time. For example, if Windows puts out something that is really good, Linux and Apple will look to develop an equivalent. The same if Linux or Apple put out something good, Windows will try to do the same. Isn't that good for all platforms? As far as cost goes, the most expensive way to compute is Apple. Like John, I will not purchase anything made by this company. If it says Apple or Mac or iPhone or iPod, I just say I don't. I believe some of their business practices should be made illegal. The cheapest way to compute is Windows. With all its flaws and costs, it just gets the job done, and about 90% of the U.S. uses it. There is also a lot of free software available for it. If I have a problem, I can find a friend or somebody at work that has experienced the problem and has the solution.
Okay, why don't you hand off to me? I'll start reading. As far as Linux is concerned, it's free, and I find it to be unbelievable. But if time is money, this way to compute is very time-consuming. For me, it's a challenge, but to others, it's a deterrent. It's not for the barely computer functional, in quotes, which I believe, at this time, is the majority of the country. Even many advanced and expert Windows users that are in news media think Linux is not ready for the mainstream. I think this is why Vista is hated by some. Did you hear me not rant there? Okay. Okay. After 5 years of XP, most don't want to change because it's different. So if these types of people try Linux, it's really different, and they stick with Windows. For me, Linux Mint is my current favorite, but I play around with other distros. Most software installs easily, but not all. For example, I like to monitor my CPU temperature because my PC is overclocked. I downloaded a program called Conky. It says it is installed, but I can't find it or use it. I guess when I have some time, I'll search till I can figure out how to get it to work. Also, the new operating system versions every 6 months is not an advantage. It just means I have to reformat every 6 months. Most computer users can't even do that. But computers are a hobby for me, and I love to play with them. So I'll just have to say, can't we all just get along? Of course, this is just my opinion. Once again, I love Linux, and you guys just keep up the good work. See ya, Gil.
Gil, my deluded friend.
Yeah, you better take this.
I agree with much of what you said. Your point, though, is that time is money, and in switching to Linux, you spend a lot more time, and therefore money, trying to figure out how to make it work. Don't underestimate the abilities of the average user to adapt to new things. Having said that, the only way I can see that Windows is less expensive to run is if you have never tried any other operating system, you already use Windows, you use a free antivirus and anti-spyware, and you only use free and open source software like Firefox, OpenOffice, FileZilla, Pigeon, and the like. Oh, and the only way you ever upgrade to a new version of your operating system is to purchase a new computer with Windows already installed. Sticking with Windows in that case does not introduce the costly lost productivity that switching to anything unfamiliar will cause, and you will never have to pay cash for software. If, on the other hand, you had never used Windows, only Mac, you would find that your lack of productivity moving to Windows would be about the same as moving to Linux. After ever using only a Mac, you would spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to find things and to make them work in Windows. Unfamiliar applications, in locations you can't find them, and they work completely differently to the way they work on the Mac. For most people, you need to add the time and money involved in fighting and preventing malware to the actual costs involved in purchasing software applications for Windows. And don't discount the hidden costs involved with the lost productivity when fighting viruses and spyware. Now that can be a high cost of ownership. In episode 72 of our podcast, that was the Computer America appearance number 16, I mentioned Glenn Moody's June 30th article in Computer World UK, and we'll have a link in the show notes to that article. In it, Glenn mentioned that the Manchester City Hall in the UK lost bust fines due to a Conficker worm infestation to the tune of £43,000. They also paid Microsoft consulting fees to fix the problem to the tune of £600,000. And, you know, listening to arguments about the high cost of ownership of Linux, well, that's just priceless. Maybe the average user doesn't hire Microsoft as a consultant, but they do spend time and money either fighting and removing malware or taking their infected computer to the Geek Guys store to get it, quote, fixed, or formatting and reinstalling Windows, service packs, updates, software applications, and settings, and so on. Linux is not more expensive, it's just different, like Mac is different, but without the multi-million dollar advertising budget to get you to try it when you're fed up of the expense of Windows. Did that sound like a Linux fan? I want to sound like a Linux fanboy, Tom. Did I sound like one?
You really are a Linux fanboy. You get your merit badge.
All right, good.
And Gil, nobody's forcing you to upgrade Linux every 6 months. In fact, with Ubuntu, you can choose to upgrade only when the new long-term support version is released every 2 years, or not at all. Also, many people are able to upgrade Ubuntu without having to wipe your hard drive. You could use that method and save time and money that way. And about Conky, it's a program that doesn't actually do much by itself, as I understand it. I think you need to add widgets to it to do the system monitoring that you're looking to do. You also need to configure it by editing the hidden ConkyRC file that's in your home directory. That might be okay for a computer hobbyist like yourself, but for the average computer user switching from Windows, you might want to try the Screenlets Daemon program available in the Ubuntu repositories. When you start the Screenlets Daemon, it also requires that you add widgets, and they are called, you guessed it, screenlets. But the daemon shows you some common screenlets, including the system monitor. It allows you to start and stop the screenlets listed, and even get new ones easily. You might want to try this alternative. And if you're running Ubuntu, you can right-click in the system tray up in the top, usually. Click on Add to Panel, and there are a list of things that you can add to your panel, and one of them is Computer Temperature Monitor. Do that, click it, you're done.
Yeah, exactly. And Gil, overall, though, I have to say that until the pain of changing from Windows is less than the pain of sticking with it, a Windows user will not switch to Linux or to Mac. With the growth of malware and the economic hardship being experienced by many people today, more and more people are finding the pain of sticking with Windows too costly. Given that Mac is financially more expensive, more and more people are actually choosing Linux and liking it.
In addition to some of the other things that Larry pointed out, you're going to have to talk about the time that you spend doing diagnostics on your computer, your defrag, your scan disk, rebooting every couple of hours because your computer slows down, reinstalling every couple of months because it's gotten buggy and quirky on you. And those are some things that are pretty much only in the Windows world. Oh, and I also saw something great in an article recently. Someone said that we should stop saying computer virus and start saying Microsoft virus because that's what always are. Okay, that was my rant.
Okay, I like the idea of calling them Microsoft viruses. Although that kind of implies that Microsoft creates them and that...
It just tolerates them.
Yeah, maybe so. I guess if you're a conspiracy theorist, maybe you think that Microsoft does create them, but...
Well, it originally wasn't meant to be networked. It was meant to be a standalone system.
Yeah, I would think if they're going to add a feature, they would make it work.
Yeah, you would think.
Well.
Okay, next, in our last user experience episode, an episode about Linux file systems, suggested by Reese, we talked about Hannah Montana Linux. And Reese wrote to us about both. He said, I just heard the show, and it was great. I really love the file structured tree pick. Some of it is still blowing my mind, but it was still good stuff. Oh, and that Hannah Montana had me laughing so hard. The colors are so ugly, it hurt my eyes. LOL.
Next, Victor wrote us. Hello, Larry and Tom. Hello, Victor.
Hey, Vic.
I just wanted to mention that I, too, have success using Linux. In fact, I've been Windows free since 2005. Before that, I was dual booting Windows and Linux since 1995, and I do more than just tweak Linux. I use it daily for all my needs. Kerry of the Computer America show says he's a Windows Power user. If so, he can certainly install Linux on his own, especially Ubuntu derivative type distros. I too am a Windows Power user and have installed many Linuxes since 1995, including the BSDs and Solaris. Any Windows Power user today can install today's Linux. It's not difficult to install. Only a few might require some reading beforehand, like Gentoo and Linux from scratch. Anyway, Larry and Tom, keep up the good work. And Vic, yes, I think Kerry is finally coming around. The videos that we did for him seem to have done the trick, and I'm hoping that by the next time I talk to him on the Computer America show, he will have tried installing it.
Yeah, he sounds like he's coming over from the dark side.
Yeah, we'll give him a chance. What do you say?
Sure. And next up, Richard of the Linux in the Ham Shack podcast wrote, Hey, Larry and Tom.
Hey, Richard.
On the last episode, Tom was talking about a malicious command in some music lyrics on a distro. Could you expand on that for me? I've been spending some time with the Linux Cranks, and I think between all of their shows and my two shows, we might be able to get the word out so this doesn't become a real problem. Oh, and as always, a great episode. Thanks. Well, thank
Thanks,
you, Richard.
By
the way, if for those who did not hear the last podcast, go take a look at the Hannah Montana thing, but stay away from it.
Yeah. And
it's funny to look at, but then that's all.
Exactly. Yeah, and that song that you were talking about, Tom, with the lyrics, when you click on the link on that Hannah Montana page and go to song, you'll see about line 20 or so. That's where the offending lyric comes in. And I'm not talking about bad words here. I'm talking about bad command line.
Right. An attempt to get you to wipe your drive.
Yes. And next, Norman wrote, Hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi,
Norman.
Hi, Norman.
I recently tried a new distribution, new for me anyways, Sabion 4.2. I had recalled Dan and Fab over at Linux Outlaws talking about it some time back. Dan dubbed it Bloody Massive Linux, as opposed to the distro Damn Small Linux. It's rather large. The ISO is a live DVD at 1.8 gigabytes download, but it just runs. It automatically includes the restricted video drivers, in my case, the NVIDIA-supplied 3D driver, Flash, MP3 codecs, etc. It looks slick. I like the default wallpaper with the Sabion logo. Open your source, open your mind. It is just not quite ready for the new Linux user. I found the update not as simple as that in Ubuntu and Mint. You can't update right from the update notification. You must open the package manager and update from there. The package manager is not as easy to use either, but with just a little experimenting, I was able to figure it out. Take a look at it. The live DVD is quite nice. The live DVD also plays a song in the background when you use it to boot to the live desktop. The Sabion people definitely did a lot of work putting this together. I say great job to them. Regarding Linux Mint over Ubuntu for ease of use for beginners, I think I tend to agree. I also like Mint's use of Thunderbird over Evolution for email. I've always wanted to remove Evolution from my Ubuntu install, but I never could because when I tried using Synaptic, it told me that it had to remove so many other things that relied on Evolution. Some things I used, or GNOME used. The one thing that drives me nuts about Mint is that slab menu. I never liked it in Windows XP and don't like it in Linux either. I always told XP to use the old style start menu. That's the main issue that keeps my distro preference as Ubuntu over Mint for my personal use. It might become Sabion now, though. Norman. Well, Norman, I'm glad you like both Linux Mint and Sabion. I heard the same Linux Outlaws episode, and it kind of turned me off of trying Sabion, quite frankly. I don't care much for bloated OSs, and based on your recommendation, I'm going to download it and try it anyway. Regarding the menu on Mint, it's very easy to replace the Mint menu with a traditional GNOME menu that you see in Ubuntu. In fact, I have moved the Mint panel from the bottom to the top and added a new one to the bottom. I replaced the Mint menu and changed the theme and icons to the traditional Ubuntu human theme. It's Mint, but it looks like Ubuntu. To get the standard GNOME menu in place of the Mint slab menu, do this. Right-click a blank area on the panel and choose Add to Panel. Select Main Menu from the list and click the Add button. Move the main menu so that it is over beside the Mint menu, then right-click that Mint menu and choose Remove from Panel. That's it. Now you've got the standard menu instead of the slab menu. Hey, Norman, thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to our show.
And Norman, if the only reason you're using Mint is to get all the nifty codecs and non-free stuff, check out Medibuntu. That's Medibuntu.org. They've got two really simple steps, and that will change your Ubuntu setup so that it includes the Medibuntu repositories that has all that cool stuff in it that may not be completely free, but now you have an Ubuntu setup that does just what Mint is out to do.
Yeah, exactly. Except you still need to know what it is you need to download to make it all work. With Mint, you've already got it there. You don't have to think about it.
Yeah, there are instructions right there on the site. If you want this, do this.
It's really good. I use Medibuntu myself.
And then as an aside, the first time I saw the name of the distro, Sabion, I went to whatever it's called, dictionary.com, and found out it's a real word, some kind of a dessert. And there you can click on a little speaker, and it will say the word for you, because I didn't know how to say it.
Yeah, it's French,
and what it said was, Sabayo. Sabayo.
Okay. Sabayo.
So let's try to get it right from now on. It's Sabayo. Okay, enough foolishness. Next up, Jason wrote, "Hello, guys."
Hi,
Hello,
Jason.
Jason. "I am reintroducing myself to your program, thanks to Linux Basement. Thank you guys for your down-to-earth and user-centric approach to Linux. I was listening to episode 74, and I heard the dilemma of a user trapped in the IE world. It's unfortunate the applications are developed with a narrow focus. As a web developer, I take great effort to give my users a consistent experience no matter what their environment. My suggestion would be to look into MS Terminal Services and the Terminal Services Client. This, of course, requires MS Terminal Services to be running on the Windows machine, I think on server editions, but this is on by default and is available for XP and later. If memory serves me, this permits multiple users to be logged in to a single box. Keep up the great work. Power to the Penguin. God bless. Jason." And oh, we got a PS. PS. "I'm interested in knowing how to make Linux, Ubuntu, work more seamlessly in a Windows environment. I work in a graduate level educational institution that is pretty open to using open source and would like to get Linux out there for the students and staff to use. I'm using likewise OpenPackage to authenticate to log in via LDAP, Active Directory, and this works great. However, connecting to other Windows shares is not so user-friendly as it requires the user to re-enter their password using the Connect to Server item in places. If you have an earlier episode, I'll eventually get to it, but I would love to hear listener feedback about their experiences or a show devoted to making it work without walls. Thanks, Jason."
Yes, thanks very much. And although, Tom, you may have stumbled over that a little bit because you're not all that familiar with networking, what Jason is getting at here is there is a software program called Likewise that allows you to connect to a Windows server, and it will authenticate your computer, that is, use your Windows login and password to connect you to the Windows network. And Likewise does that, like the Microsoft setup for Active Directory. And if you don't have the server configured to use it, what happens is when you do connect to a Microsoft directory, it will connect just fine, but you have to enter your password and your username every time you connect. So, Jason, what I would say is that if your network people, your server people, can set up what's needed for Likewise, then you won't need to use your Windows login and password. It will just recognize it and authenticate your computer based on the Active Directory rules. But if they won't do that, or if there's another server where that's not set up, then of course you're just stuck with having to use the password and the login name that you would normally use. And if any of our listeners are more familiar with the networking environment that is Windows and connecting a Linux computer to it, and those listeners have more information to contribute to Jason, please write in and let us know. Next is an email from Judy. She sent this one from her mobile phone. She wrote, "Hello, Larry and Long." No, she didn't. I'm just making fun of mobile phone typists. I have a problem typing with my thumbs, too. She said, "Hello, Larry and Tom." "Hello, Judy."
"Hello, Judy."
"I've been listening to Going Linux for a while, and I've enjoyed it a lot. I just installed Ubuntu 9.04 on my HP Vista computer and wiped out Vista. The only problem I've had is that my Creative Sound Blaster Audigy X-Fi 24-bit Extreme sound card doesn't work. I have no sound coming from my computer. I've tried to use the forums to get help, but I know nothing about the terminal and using the command line. I didn't have to use the command line in Windows. I would like to continue using Ubuntu. I'm still trying to get used to different terminology used in Linux, and that also makes it difficult for me to understand everything that's said in Linux user forums. Can you tell me where I can get help? Thanks for any help you can give. Judy." Any comments, Tom?
Didn't you write her back with a solution?
I just told her that she had to wait until they caught up with the drivers.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty much where we're at.
Yeah, Judy, I know what you're talking about being frustrated with the terminology. When I first started listening to Linux podcasts, that frustrated me to no end. On this podcast, we do try to explain at least once if we say GUI or GUI that it's the graphical user interface and that sort of thing. So we're trying to help there. As far as that old Creative Labs, how old of a Sound Blaster do you suppose that is, Larry?
I don't know. I remember looking it up and I don't recall whether it was a really old one or a really new one, but I do remember finding out that there was a lot of issue with that particular model of Sound Blaster and Creative. Depending on what model it is, may or may not make their drivers available to the Linux community. So I think this is one of those situations where we have to wait for the community to catch up. And if this particular sound card is not all that popular, in other words, if HP and other computer manufacturers didn't use it for very long, we
Might not
may not,
happen.
yeah, it might not happen. So I really don't have a solution for this one, unfortunately. If anybody out there has some advice, let's know.
Always a problem when the manufacturers don't let us know what's inside the box and what we need to do to talk to it.
Yep.
And the community can only do so much.
Yes.
And we're getting the next major upgrade to Ubuntu in what, November?
October. Nine
October.
point nine, 9.10. So October with the point 10
Maybe
being
it'll
that
start
month.
working then.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Okay, and next up, Scott wrote, and he says, "Hi, Tom and Larry." Hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
I had toyed around going Linux for a while, and this weekend was it. I got my daughter's computer after the third recovery disk failed using XP Recovery. And now, no way I know of to try from recovery partition on the drive after that. So I installed Watt OS, WATTOS, a small, light, and fast operating system, and I found everything I had with Windows except to run iTunes. Not sure if Wine would work to help it run, or if it would run anyway. The only other problem, though, is that I cannot get icons on the desktop from the start menu. I cannot get the Flock browser to load after downloading it from the website. It is from Mozilla and it would not run, and the website said it was a Linux download. I listened to the show, but not intently enough, apparently. Thanks, Scott. Larry, what the heck is the Watt OS? That's the first I've heard of that.
Yeah, the Watt OS, I did a little research and background on this. We'll include a link to the Watt OS website, which is planetwatt.com. They are on their beta 3 of the Watt OS. And remember what Tom found on beta software and his experience with Skype. Just a word of warning. Not to cast any aspersions on the Watt OS folks, but it is labeled Beta 3. It was released in June of 2009 and appears to be a remix of Ubuntu. And they have several different versions. The Watt OS itself, which is GNOME base with Watt OS customizations. They have another version called Milliwatt, which is XFCE based. MicroWatt, which is OpenBox and LXDE based. With that gives it a lot more lightweight controls and components. And they also have a version called Substation. That's their server version. No graphical user interface, just webmin control and console capability. So you get the idea, the power substation and micro and milliwatt. This is a powerful distribution.
Oh, power
Get it?
on.
Ah, yes. Anyway, so since it's based on Ubuntu, I would expect that if you're using the GNOME-based version of it, the Watt OS main version, that to add icons to your desktop, you would simply open the menu and drag the icon to your desktop. We also have several articles written on our articles tab on how to add icons to your desktop. So if you have trouble just dragging them to your desktop, take a look at those articles as well. Just do a search on our page and you'll find it. Tom, any suggestion on iTunes?
Well, there are iTunes-like replacements. I don't think we've got a, I don't know, somebody out there, tell us, is there an iTunes clone for Linux?
Yeah, I think the best bet there would be to use the, you know, Rhythmbox or,
Amarok.
Yeah, all those. The problem there is you have no access to the iTunes store, which is what most people
True.
Want. You know, they want to be able to look at their music. They want to spend the money they've got sitting there ready to be spent in the iTunes store and, you know, download podcasts or whatever from there. And that's why people, I think, most people are turning to iTunes, that and the fact that when you're working with an iPod Touch or an iPhone or something like that, you
Sure.
can't play the music on it that you move to it from your computer's hard drive. It's blocked unless you jailbreak the iPhone. So they've restricted the hardware so that it only works with iTunes, basically.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. But as far as running iTunes in Wine is concerned, probably not going to work. I tried connecting an iPhone to iTunes by way of a virtual machine, and unfortunately, the iPhone that I was using has a USB interface, and under Linux, the USB port didn't work when I was using VirtualBox, which was the virtual environment that I was running it in. So I'm not sure that's going to work. Certainly it's not going to work with my computer in VirtualBox. So if there's another way to make it work, let me know. Write us in or send us a voice comment.
However, those of you with Zunes, there is a program in the repositories. And I believe it's called QLIX, QLIX, which purportedly is able to turn your proprietary Zune interface into a much more manageable MSD or mass storage device, or at least emulate one, so that you can drag and drop files in and out.
Interesting. So QLIX is like Zune spelled sideways or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Moving on to Mike's email, he wrote us, "Help! I'm interested in building a site where you can upload, download, and listen to MP3 music clips a la GarageBand charts. I was told that Linux Gang has all the answers. What's involved? Tech qualifications? How do you suggest I proceed? Thanks." Well, Mike, I don't think we have all the answers.
No.
No, not at all. I think you could build this kind of a site.
I don't think either one of us has messed around with streaming MP3s on the internet. I know it's possible. I've seen packages that are supposed to be able to do it, but I've never had an interest in it. So,
yeah, and
sorry,
I've never tried it either.
No experience there.
Yeah, and I don't think it's something that requires Linux to do it right. It's something you could do on Windows or Mac just as easily. It sounds like you just need to set up a website and make it available either as a stream or a podcast download, or maybe just have the files there that people can click on and download. It depends on what you want. And you can do that with simple blog software. So you could set that up from a triple EPC if you wanted to. You don't need any special computing hardware to make that sort of thing work. So good luck.
Yeah. If what you want to do is just put a bunch of MP3s on a page and have people be able to play them right there on the page, we'll put a link to the code on the, in the show notes.
Sure.
Next up, Adam wrote, "I would consider my interest in Linux a hobby. I've been tinkering with various distros for about 3 years. I have no background with computers, programming, networking, engineering, or anything of the sort. I would consider myself moderately savvy. I'm past the dangerous stage, where I knew just enough to foobar my system with one command. And now I'm at the stage where I know enough that I keep my Linux system secure and stable for a while, until I decide that I'm not happy with the way my system is set up, and then I start over again. My latest Linux project I've been working on is a home server installed on an older extra computer. I'd like a file server, a backup server, a media server, and a torrent box. My question is specifically about the file server aspect. Are there any problems that might arise from using a Linux file system formatted drive, such as ext3 or 4, as a network drive on a Windows computer? For example, in one of my previous experiments, I moved the Windows My Documents folder so that when I clicked on the My Documents folder in my Windows computer, it accessed the ext3 formatted directory of my Linux server. I did this partly out of curiosity and partly because my massive music collection was slowing down iTunes to a crawl. After using this setup for a few weeks, I noticed that iTunes performance was much better, and generally the directories loaded faster, even when there were 5,000 pictures inside. I think I understand that Windows and NTFS stores data in a way that's significantly different from Linux and the journaled file system. So, my concern is that writing and erasing using Windows on a Linux file system formatted drive will corrupt the data or cause unforeseen problems in the future. If there's a better way, I'd also like to know how. Thanks. I think the podcast is great. There are so few Linux podcasts out there, it's great to have a well-done, informative, and regularly updated podcast like Going Linux. I hope you guys keep this going strong for years to come.
Well, Adam, I have some comments for you. And I think your experience with iTunes running faster when using a file system based on Linux is telltale. The NTFS setup and any other Windows file format, much like we were talking about in the last episode, requires that Windows write a little piece of data, check to see if there's still enough space. If it can't find it, it'll record the rest of the file somewhere else and spew those fragments all over the hard drive. Linux doesn't do that. A Linux formatted file system ensures that the file fragmentation is eliminated or kept to a minimum.
Yeah, it's like it is commonly 2 or 3% fragmented.
Yeah. So as a result, when you're accessing it using iTunes, it's going to run faster because the program doesn't have to look all over the hard drive to find a single file. So as far as your worries about using a Linux file system from a Windows computer, don't worry at all. You're connecting by way of a network connection, not to the disk directly. And even if you were connecting to the disk directly, there wouldn't be a problem there. There are programs that you can get for Windows that allow it to read Linux file systems. But over a network, your computer doesn't care what's on the other end of the network. As long as it's accessible through the network connection, it will function just fine. No problems at all. As a matter of fact, in corporations where they run their servers on Linux, oftentimes they are supporting from that Linux server a number of Windows computers, and those Windows computers share files routinely on those Linux servers, just like what you're doing in your home network. And in addition, if you've ever purchased or ever used a network-attached storage hard drive, those 500 gigabyte and 1 terabyte and 1.5 terabyte drives, many of them are Linux drives. There are hard drives formatted using the Linux file system, and then they have a web application that runs that allows you to connect to them from any computer, Windows, Linux, Mac, doesn't matter. And all your files there are stored using the Linux file system for the most part. It's designed to work that way. There is no risk. And in fact, as you've observed, it might just run faster than it does on a native Windows formatted hard drive. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, thank you.
Our last email for today is from Jacob. And Jacob corrected us. He said, "Hey, Larry and Tom."
Hey, Jacob. What did we screw up?
In your recent Linux File Systems Beginner podcast, you stated that IDE hard drives show up as /dev/HDX, X representing a number varying from one to whatever, and SATA drives as /dev/SDX. While this used to be true, they all pretty much show up as /dev/SDX anymore on more recent versions of Linux, including the USB drives. There's a kernel option that you can compile to go back to the old naming system, but most distributions use the newer system. Anyway, keep up the great work. Good, Captain.
Jacob, I can't keep up with all this newfangled stuff. You whippersnapper.
Hey, thanks for the correction. I wasn't aware of that. I had an older version of Linux that some of my hard drives showed up with the H instead of the S, and I've noticed after reading your email that everything I've got today, even the old IDE drives, show up with SD1, SD2, and so on. So, interesting stuff, and thanks for the correction.
Know.
Yeah.
And by the clock on the wall, I see that we're running out of time here, so we won't be able to get to some folks. We've got emails from Victor and Jason and Miko Y, Tony, Jonathan, Jay, Martin, David A, Brian, Izhar, Robert, Tim, Placido, and Yo Panda Bear.
And maybe we'll get to cover them in the next Computer America episode. And if not, most of those folks I have already, or Tom has already, written an email in response. So please forgive us if we don't get to your email. But please keep sending it in. We love the email and love helping you out. Tom, software pick. Is yours Skype?
Yes, the new Skype beta is unbelievable. And it runs in Hannah Montana Linux.
Let me cover mine and let you regain your composure, Tom.
All right, I will.
My software pick is something you referred me to, and that is Compiz Switch. This is a little program that allows you to easily turn on and off your Compiz iCandy on your Linux desktop using a little icon in the GNOME panel. You just click the icon and Compiz is on. Click it again, Compiz is off. Simple as that. And we'll include a link to Forlong's blog, and it's at forlong.bloggage.de. And in a post from January 2008, he posts the software, which is Compiz Switch, and that's Compiz-Switch if you're searching on Google. But this little thing has really helped me out. I was having a bit of a problem, Tom, manually switching the Compiz effects on and off, where if I switched them off and I tried to switch them on again, they wouldn't switch on, and I had to actually go into the terminal and type in Compiz space dash check, and that's a built-in check of the Compiz settings to ensure that your computer is capable of handling the Compiz settings. And when I did that, it flipped some sort of switch somewhere and allowed me then to turn on Compiz. Well, when I went to install Compiz Switch, I noticed that Forlong also has a little script that he has posted, he or she has posted, and that does something that looks the same as the Compiz check, but it's a script that does much more than that. When I ran that, it checked not only to see whether Compiz was capable of being run on my computer, but it also checked to see if there were any conflicts, and it found one. Apparently, Ubuntu has some sort of native desktop effects that can conflict with CompIz, and they were turned on. Well, this little CompIz check script offered to disable that feature. And when I did that, now the CompIz switch in my panel works perfectly. All I have to do is one click on, one click off, one click on, one click off. I spent a half an hour just switching it on and off, on and off.
Click on, click off.
Yeah.
Click on, click off.
So, Tom, thanks. And Forlong, thank you for creating that. That's a really great pick.
So is that it, Larry?
That's it for today, unless you have a real software pick.
No.
Okay. In our next episode, we will have a Computer America episode. This will be my 18th appearance on Computer America. So until then, you can go to our articles and show notes at the goinglinux.com webpage for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations. Feel free to email us with your comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button on the left-hand side of our page to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on the Podcast Alley page.
And you can also send us an audio comment by email. That's electric mail. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word.
You can download our episodes from our website. You can use the Flash player to play them right there on the show notes page as well.
You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as a new episode is available. For instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com.
And speaking of Flash players, Tom, have you been to our homepage lately? I have put a little play button right next to our latest episode. And if you click on that and you have scripts enabled to run, it'll run a little script that'll launch a player right there on a separate little player window and play our latest episode right from the main Going Linux page.
Oh, cool. I'll have to go look at that.
So until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.